From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Uncertainty layered upon uncertainty. Ever since President Trump first announced he had tested positive for the novel coronavirus, confusion has reigned over this very delicate moment for the United States. And it comes to a head around the truth of the president's health. First, on Friday, the White House said the president would be staying put. Then suddenly a change, an abundance of caution, as the president was hospitalized at Walter Reed Medical Center.
I want to thank everybody for the tremendous support. I'm going to Walter Reed Hospital. I think I'm doing very well.
On Saturday, the president's medical team at first painted a rosy picture of Trump's health and treatment. Navy Commander Dr. Sean Conley also revealed that the president had been administered a series of experimental drugs and antibody treatments.
We're maximizing all aspects of his care, attacking this virus, multi-pronged approach. As the president, I didn't want to hold anything back. If there was any possibility that it would add value to his care and expedite his return, I wanted to take it.
Had the president been on oxygen, though? Conley was cagey. The White House chief of staff indicated the president's illness was more serious than officials let on, and reporters then unearthed that, in fact, the president's blood oxygen level had dropped, and he had been given supplemental oxygen. So on Sunday, Conley clarified.
Didn't want to give any information that might steer the course of illness in another direction. And in doing so, it came off that we were trying to hide something, which wasn't necessarily true.
And after each confusing press conference, the president himself weighed in, posting videos of his own. On Sunday, he told his 86.9 million Twitter followers,
I'm not telling anybody but you, but I'm about to make a little surprise visit. So perhaps I'll get there before you get to see me. But I just, when I look at the enthusiasm, and we have enthusiasm like probably nobody's ever had.
And then the president of the United States, moments later, COVID positive and on a mix of experimental treatments, climbed into an armored SUV to drive by and wave at supporters gathering at Walter Reed Medical Center. So those are just a few moments from a weekend that was defined by changes in the news, by backtracking, by questions, by answers, which begat yet more questions about the health and well-being of the president of the United States. Is that chaos, that confusion, that lack of clarity having an impact on the health and well-being of the country? Well, today we're going to talk with three experts to pursue some clarity and to ask what are the questions they need answers to right now about the president's health. So let's begin with an infectious disease specialist. Michael Mina is a professor of epidemiology, immunology, and infectious disease at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. Dr. Mina, welcome back to the show.
Thanks. Very happy to be here.
So first of all, let me ask you, if you had a patient who was in their 70s and was put on an experimental antibody cocktail that hadn't yet been cleared out of clinical trial, was also put on remdesivir, then was also put on dexamethasone, what would that tell you about the progression of that person's COVID disease?
Well, certainly the use of these drugs is being has largely been reserved for the most severe cases and for people who are not necessarily having a positive course at the moment. Remdesivir has been being used with certain success for a while now, but certainly dexamethasone, for example, is something it's a double-edged sword. It's a steroid, and it can both turn down somebody's immune system, and that's intentional here because it's really the pathology, the immune system damage that the body can do can sometimes be more damaging than the virus itself. So we don't want to use dexamethasone too early because it can actually affect how well the body can naturally fight off the virus. We only want to use it if somebody's sort of taking a wrong turn in their recovery. And so I think that it tells me, anyway, that that potentially the president is not necessarily doing as rosy as some of the physician reports have been.
Well, he has put out these videos, though, and he talking directly to the world, not just the American people. He went out on that SUV ride yesterday in front of his supporters gathered at Walter Reed. Is that evidence of better health than a dexamethasone treatment might indicate?
It could be. It's really hard. It's very, very difficult to know with this president. You know, is he directing his course? Are the physicians directing his course? I mean, he's a very strong-willed person, as we all know. And if he can he muster up the energy to get out and get into an SUV? Yes, I think he could, even without, even if he wasn't in the greatest shape. But I do think that it's hard to interpret much here, because we know sort of his personality over these years. We've learned a lot about how he can make things happen, even if they're maybe not necessarily in his own or the country's best interest sometimes. And so it's unclear really what's happening at the moment.
Unclear, to say the least. But Dr. Mina, just to underscore the choice to put the president on dexamethasone, if I understand correctly, the NIH itself has recommended, to your point, that be reserved for severe cases of COVID. I mean, severe meaning what?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So it's usually reserved for people who are showing some sort of damage with their breathing, for example. We look at something called an oxygen saturation, and that allows us to know how well somebody's lungs are functioning. If the virus is doing damage to the lungs because it's a respiratory virus, it can sometimes harm people's ability to breathe, and that will lower the amount of oxygen that's in their body. And so when that gets below a certain level, usually around below 95, usually around 94-93%, then we start to say, hey, this person isn't just kind of having a mild viral infection. They're more in the severe category. And that's when we might start thinking about things like dexamethasone. And we have heard that the president has had fluctuating oxygen saturation levels. We haven't heard much about his clinical course, but we have heard that fluctuations have occurred. And that largely represents that just those numbers alone do suggest that the president has been on more of what, at least pushing onto the side of a severe, what we would consider a severe COVID case versus a mild or potentially asymptomatic case.
Okay, two more quick things. There's a lot of talk amongst, I guess you could say, infectious disease Twitter, but among specialists in your field about some of the side effects that come with dexamethasone treatment. I'm seeing here, this is from a former dean of Harvard Medical School who points to a study out of the Mayo Clinic that says that 6% of people placed on dexamethasone and other steroids at therapeutic doses have a severe psychological reaction. 29% have mild or moderate reactions. Is this of concern, Dr. Mina?
I think it should be. And I think it really speaks more loudly to the idea that he's probably not, you know, that he probably is more on the severe side of things. If they're willing to give him a drug like dexamethasone, which does have known psychological effects. It's not the worst drug in the world for psychological effects in terms of side effects, but he is our president, and he is still working in that capacity. So I think it should be considered, very strongly that anything with psychological effects like dexamethasone be only given if needed. And I hope that has been the thinking of the physicians, and that this isn't sort of a patient running their own course of therapy. But it is difficult to say, but I do think it should be, it's certainly a concern to me.
So if you had a chance, if you were in one of those medical briefings that are being given right outside of Walter Reed, and you had a chance to ask a question of the president's doctors, what would be your first question, Dr. Mina?
Well, it's hard. I mean, as a physician, we want to see the whole patient record. You know, we want to see what's really happening with this patient. We know that he's also gotten monoclonal antibodies, for example, and these are very, very powerful. I think that these have hold a lot of promise. So I would want to know things like, do they seem to be working? And frankly, just be straight with America. That my question would be, what is the president's condition? He is the elected president of the United States, and the country, and frankly, the world deserves to know, because we have stock markets riding on his well-being. We have, you know, just innumerable things in our society are riding on this. And I would want to ask the question, are you being straight with us? Because so far, it's been very, very difficult to discern.
Well, Dr. Mina, stand by here, because let's turn now to a person who is a member of the White House press corps. Paula Reed joins us. She is White House and Justice correspondent for CBS News. Paula, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Have reporters, after many days of this confusion, had a chance to ask the president's medical team if they're being straight with the country?
That did come up yesterday at the briefing, specifically the contradictory statements from the president's medical team and then the chief of staff, Mark Meadows. After that first briefing, the medical team tried to paint a rosy picture, and then the chief of staff, Mark Meadows, went over to the group of reporters, asked to speak anonymously, and gave a much more dire assessment of the president's symptoms over the previous then 24 hours and talked about being concerned about the path to recovery. And that was, of course, very confusing. Yesterday, he was asked, the doctor, Dr. Conley, was asked why they couldn't keep their story straight. And once again, he said what we've really heard from the Trump administration throughout the pandemic is that he wanted to project a rosy outlook. But people don't want a rosy outlook right now. They want facts, and it's very hard to trust what you're hearing when you have a doctor who says, yes, the president is doing well, he's only has these minor symptoms, but then you look at the treatment regimen he's receiving and you think, well, these two things cannot both be true. The White House's other efforts to release videos and pictures showing the president working have also been botched. In one of them, it appears they edited out a cough. They're only taken a few minutes apart, even though it looks like he's doing different activities. And he's not wearing a mask, but it appears in one they say that his chief of staff is in the room in addition to whoever's taking these pictures. So while there's a long history of being secretive about the health of an American president, the messaging here, it's just astoundingly, it's incompetent.
Well, Paula Reed and Dr. Michael Mina, stand by. We are trying to find out what are the right questions to which the American people need the answers to regarding the president's health right now. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are trying to understand what are the best questions that the American people need the answers to right now regarding the health of the president of the United States. I'm joined today by Paula Reed. She is the White House and DOJ correspondent for CBS News. Dr. Michael Mina also joins us as well. He's an assistant professor of epidemiology, immunology, and infectious diseases at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. And we want to play another moment here from yesterday's press conference with the president's medical team. Here is Dr. Sean Conley, the White House physician, explaining why he hadn't previously disclosed that the president had been receiving supplemental oxygen.
I was trying to reflect the upbeat attitude that the team, the president, that his course of illness has had. I didn't want to give any information that might steer the course of illness in another direction. And in doing so, it came off that we were trying to hide something, which wasn't necessarily true. Here I have it. The fact of the matter is that he's doing really well.
That's Dr. Conley yesterday. Dr. Mina, I wonder if you could just for a moment put yourself in the White House physician's shoes, and especially when he said there that the phrase that caught my attention was, I didn't want to give any information that might steer the course of illness in another direction. So, he's giving the information to reporters and to the American people, but there he's talking about how what the impact of that information would be on the president who would be watching this press conference. I mean, is that a concern that a physician should have in this situation?
Yeah, that caught my ear as well. And I think that's really concerning to me that that's the way that they're thinking. you know, this to me is another example of magical thinking by the president and his team. The words that they say to us are not going to steer the president's illness in any different direction. That's going to be the care that the president gives and the course that the president's body and viral infection end up taking. And I find it very concerning. I mean, again, just be straight with us. There is so much more riding on this than you know, essentially any other person in the world to get infected today. And if he is saying things like he doesn't want to give any information that might steer the illness in a different direction, that is just that it doesn't even make sense, frankly.
Well, I mean, is he possibly saying there? I'm asking you to conjecture. I recognize that. But is he possibly saying there that he's concerned that if President Trump were to hear him tell the truth in these press conferences, that would so upset the president that the additional stress of the upset of being upset upon hearing the truth being told would steer the course of the illness in another direction?
Well, I think it would be naive to think that that's not part of it. Certainly, everyone is at the whim of what the president wants these days, and what they, you know, that's how they respond. Those who are working with him, and I think that, you know, very likely, if his physician comes out and says the truth, and it's not something Trump wants, Trump will just replace him. He's fired how many people in his administration at this point, and so. I think that that's part of it, but you know, whether he's really doing it to protect the president's sort of psychological well-being and help him to sort of make it through the best he can, so he doesn't adversely affect the psychological sort of status of the president, is difficult to say.
Okay, so Paula, let's expand our circle of analysis here a little bit. I mean, it's been several days now since officially the world knew of the president's COVID diagnosis. We've had many other folks around him subsequently also test positive. Regarding how the White House is operating specifically, has the White House made any specific changes about masking, testing, about creating a safer environment for the staffers who work there right now?
No, not really. You see a few more masks following the president's diagnosis. I was in the West Wing several hours after that was announced. You saw a few more masks in the West Wing, but a lot of people were just putting them on when they saw reporters like myself and my colleagues coming closer to them. They tend to wear them now, especially in times when there are cameras around. But for the past 7-8 months, this administration has taken a very cavalier attitude towards this virus in the West Wing. People do not wear masks. They do not socially distance, and sometimes they mock their colleagues who do take precautions. Now, I want to just weigh in on the question of what the doctor was doing there. Uh-huh. Of course, he's trying not to antagonize the president. That's also why the chief of staff wanted to speak anonymously when he gave a more dire assessment of the president's health. That's why you don't see Dr. Birx at Walter Reed. That's why you don't see Dr. Fauci. Both of them have sort of been sidelined because they would not stick to the message that the president wanted. So, yes, in this White House, you either toe the line and say what the president wants to hear, or you risk being sidelined or worse, fired. So that is absolutely what he was doing. And he was actually being pretty transparent. He's saying, yeah, I don't want to give anything but a rosy prediction because I don't want to antagonize the president and make his condition worse. I mean, he basically came out and said it. That's one thing that's actually a little refreshing about this doctor, is he doesn't do a lot of media training. But he said other things about the timeline mm-hmm. of this diagnosis that we really do have to continue to press. Was he being candid and revealing things the White House didn't want us to know? Or did he misspeak because he was, again, he's nervous, not used to reporters.
So, I mean, so since you mentioned that, for people who haven't been following like every second of developments over the weekend, the timeline, meaning there was a point at which Conley said that that some sort of treatment had first started, this was a couple of days ago, 72 hours ago versus 3 days ago, meaning that the president's first COVID positive test might have been much earlier than the White House initially reported. I mean, clarify what you mean.
Exactly. So in his first press conference, he suggested that the president had been diagnosed with COVID or knew he had COVID for about 72 hours, which would mean at that time Wednesday. Now, that is concerning for a lot of reasons. Obviously, the White House could have potentially misled the American public. But the president also went to a series of campaign events on Wednesday, and then on Thursday, he went to a fundraiser. And this is really something that the White House has been pressed on. When did the president know he had exposure to a positive case, and when did he first test positive? Because as you know, he takes the rapid test, the quick test, and then you get the more comprehensive PCR test as well. The White House has been really dodgy about this. So when his doctor came out and suggested that, in fact, maybe he knew he had this a day before he announced it, that was big news. Now the doctor has subsequently issued a written statement saying that he misspoke, right? That he meant to say 3 days, not 72 hours. But we have to be skeptical there. You know, military doctors aren't exactly known for just throwing terminology around and not being precise. So there's still a lot of questions that journalists are pursuing about exactly when the president was tested, how often he tested negative, and up until what point. What day, what hour, what time did he know he had this? And then what did he do after that? Did he go to fundraisers? Did he expose other people? Still an open question.
One more question, Paula, about sort of the number of people around the president who have been who've also tested positive. Since we don't know sort of who the patient zero is in this case, we can't tell if it was the president who spread it or they who gave it to him. I'm not conjecturing at all on that. But I believe there was news that the attorney general, Bill Barr, is he self-isolating now?
He's working from home today, I believe. He has had several tests, quick tests, and even the PCR test. If I remember correctly, he is working from home today, but it doesn't appear that he's committed to a full quarantine, even though he has. He was at that event. He was at what now appears to be a super spreader event at the White House about 10 days ago in the Rose Garden to announce the new justice nominee. So right now, you know, the number of people who attended that event who have subsequently tested positive continues to grow. And then you have not only those people, but then the second wave of people they encountered subsequently and may have infected. So that number, that list continues to grow. And the attorney general is certainly someone folks are watching very closely, given his age, given his weight, and of course, his important position in American government.
So, Michael Mina, let me turn back to you, because we outside of Walter Reed, outside of the president's medical team, have all of these questions about the truth of the president's current state of health. The medical team has those current answers. So the fact that there's discussion that they may release the president from Walter Reed today to have him allow him to go back to the White House, does that actually give you reason for optimism?
Personally, not much at all. I think, you know, the White House can be, they have an amazing amount of resources that they can move a hospital room into a White House room, for example. So I'll read very little, knowing how this president operates, I'll read very little into it, except that he wants to project an image of strength. And if that means from his perspective, moving out of Walter Reed and getting back into the White House, we don't know what happens in the White House once he's isolated in his room. They might have a whole hospital room set up there for him. It's very difficult to know.
Okay. So it has been decades since a president of the United States has been hospitalized at Walter Reed for this length of time. The coronavirus positive test that the president had, well, I mean, now he's one of more than 7 million Americans who've tested positive. And just as a reminder, 210,000 Americans have died. So I think it's actually worth at this moment to also open up the question about should the White House be taking into consideration the nation's readiness if President Trump, comes to a point where he's unable to discharge the duties of his office.
The 25th Amendment, either Section 3 and Section 4, is not just for when the president's unconscious. It's not just for when the president is going to be unconscious. It's when the president is physically, mentally, or logistically unable to discharge the powers and duties of his or her office.
That is Professor Joel Goldstein. He's a presidential and constitutional law scholar at St. Louis University, and he talked to us about exactly what the 25th Amendment is designed to do. And he told us it provides two ways for power to be transferred to the vice president. One way is voluntarily, as laid out in Section 3 of the 25th Amendment. And in fact, that has been done three times under Presidents George H.W. Bush and President George W. Bush.
There have been other instances where presidents were prepared to use Section 3 when they anticipated that they might be undergoing procedures under general anesthesia, but then it didn't happen.
Now, Section 4 of the 25th Amendment allows the vice president and a majority of the cabinet to transfer power if the president is unwilling or unable.
The concern is that this is not a time to play politics. I don't know whether or not the president is unable or not. But if the facts develop such that the president is unable, one would be concerned that about a reluctance to make that determination because of the possible impact on the election.
Now, it does seem very unlikely that the president's cabinet, that President Trump's cabinet or Vice President Mike Pence would force a transfer of power away from President Trump, even if they deemed it necessary this close to the election.
The decision makers, both in the executive branch, the vice president, the members of the cabinet, the members of the House, the members of the Senate, have all taken an oath to support the Constitution. And the Constitution envisions that when a president is unable to discharge the powers and duties of the office and doesn't so declare himself or herself, perhaps because they didn't have the opportunity or perhaps because they're unwilling to, that other people will act as patriots, not as partisans.
That's Professor Joel Goldstein, a presidential and constitutional law scholar at St. Louis University. Paula Reed, has there been any even whispers or inkling of a discussion of the possibility of even preparing for a Section 3 use of the 25th Amendment?
Not a public one. If there are any whispers, they are very swiftly hushed. Now, this is a president and an administration that does not want to project any weakness, particularly given the larger context of this situation. So I know, for example, yesterday, my colleague Margaret Brennan on Face the Nation asked the National Security Advisor Robert O'Brien about this. And he just said, look, that's not something that's on the table at this point. They're really not willing to discuss any sort of contingency plans. They don't even want to go there. And it goes back to the point we made earlier. They don't want to draw the ire of President Trump.
Well, since you mentioned Margaret Brennan's interview of Robert O'Brien, here is that moment.
No, that's not something that's on the table at this point. Again, the president, you saw him on the video last night.
But it may be, as you just said.
Well, he's doing very well, and just like it could happen to anybody, but we're prepared. Look, we have a great vice president. We have a government that is steady and is steady at the tiller. And we'll be briefing the president this afternoon. General Milley, Secretary Pompeo, myself will be giving him a national security brief this afternoon from the White House here. He'll be at Walter Reed, so we'll do it by secure video conference or secure phone. So the government's doing well. The president's doing well. And I'm not going to address hypotheticals, but we have plans for everything.
National Security Council Director Robert O'Brien speaking to CBS's Margaret Brennan. Dr. Mina, just this is taking me back for a second to our discussion of the potential side effects of a dexamethasone treatment. I mean, if you were on the president's medical team, what kinds of symptoms medically would you be looking for that would raise the question of the president's ability to discharge his duties of office?
Well, I think that I'm not a psychiatrist, but I would certainly want the president hope that while he's on dexamethasone in particular, that he's getting regular psych evals. You know, is he getting those psych evals? I would be kind of surprised, to be honest. But I hope that they are doing that and having trained psychiatrists who are able to evaluate any. Really, what you want to know is, does he have any change from his baseline? Is he acting in any way that's inappropriate, that isn't quite himself and any evidence at all that he might be compromised in his ability to make appropriate decisions for the country. Every small decision that somebody in his position makes, you know, has the potential to affect millions, if not billions of people on Earth. And so we need to ensure at every step of this process that he is maintaining his most appropriate baseline, you know, and I hope that he's getting evaluations on a very regular basis while he's being treated.
Well, Dr. Michael Mina is an assistant professor of epidemiology, immunology, and infectious disease at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. Thank you so much for joining us today, Dr. Mina.
Absolutely. Thanks very much.
Paula Reed, hang on here for just a second. We'll have a lot more to talk about when we come back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
Smart journalism. Fascinating topics. Words that describe CNN's podcast, The Assignment with Audie Cornish.
Last year, the Army missed its recruitment goal. It had 65,000 spots to fill and came up 10,000 short of that target. Why is it so hard to recruit? How's the Pentagon responding? And how are the voices of service members on social media shifting the balance?
Listen to The Assignment with Audie Cornish wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tomorrow on the show, we're going to be talking about education in the era of the coronavirus, because most kids in the United States of school age are back in school. Maybe it's online, all remote. Maybe it's hybrid. Maybe it's in person. But the pandemic, way back when, in March, according to some education experts, gave this country a chance to rethink what education could be for the 21st century. Did that actually happen? So we are going to talk with those two professors of education again, checking in with them 7 months later. And teachers and educators and parents, will you tell us, how are you approaching school right now? What's working and what's not? Call us with your story at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. That's for tomorrow's program. Today, we are talking about the confusion and chaos around the truth regarding the health of the President of the United States. I'm joined today by Paula Reed. She is a correspondent, a White House correspondent, and Justice Department correspondent for CBS News. And joining us now as well is Olivia Troy. She began her career in Homeland Security and national security after the attacks of September 11th in 2001. She served at the Pentagon in the George W. Bush administration, continued her government service at the Department of Homeland Security and the Office of the Vice President, and then as an aide to Vice President Mike Pence on the White House COVID Task Force. She left that work in August. Olivia Troy, welcome to you.
Thank you, Meghna. Thank you for having me.
I just want to play for you a clip from the president from just yesterday. And it's the video he sent out just before he climbed into that armored SUV to greet his supporters outside of Walter Reed.
It's been a very interesting journey. I learned a lot about COVID. I learned it by really going to school. This is the real school. This isn't the let's read the book school. And I get it, and I understand it, and it's a very interesting thing, and I'm going to be letting you know about it.
And here is how one physician at Walter Reed, Dr. James Phillips, a non-military attending physician, reacted to that. He was on CNN.
The idea that this would be cleared without any medical indication is absurd. The only reason why someone with COVID-19, severe COVID-19, causing hypoxia on multiple IV drugs should ever be leaving the hospital would be in an ambulance to be transferred to a higher level of care. Well, there is no higher level of care than what our president is currently getting.
Olivia, I wanted to play those moments of the many moments over the past weekend just to ask you, how would you judge what the White House's response or handling of the information around the health of the president has been over the past 2 or 3 days?
Meghna, I think this is no different than what we have seen play out from day one of the pandemic, unfortunately. I mean, this has so many national security implications and continuity of government implications. You know, I never want to see the president sick. You know, I'm a patriot and I've been in this profession for quite some time. On the other hand, I have to say that, you know, the president saying that he now can lead on it because he's personally experienced it while he's actually still a contagious individual and still potentially not out of the woodwork. I mean, he's still not out of the realm of possibility that he could take a turn for the worse, and I'm praying that he doesn't. But I'm shocked that he would say this publicly when, quite frankly, all of us in America have been waiting for him to lead on this from day one, not just because it now has touched him and he is now part of the experience that the rest of the country has been feeling.
Can you take us inside the White House prior to your departure in August? I mean, what was the attitude around mask wearing? How close do people get to each other?
They don't. I mean, the White House is, you know, the West Wing is very small. People work in very close proximity to each other. And in this situation, it would be prudent for every single person to be wearing a mask just as a precaution for themselves and each other, their families, and also for the president and the vice president. But, you know, as much as Dr. Conley tried to implement protocols and others, I know the deputy national security advisor, Matt Pottinger, spoke out very strongly about this from day one. He was one of the first people to be wearing a mask back in January. No one really adhered to the policy. It just wasn't taken seriously. It was like we lived in the White House bubble where somehow we thought that this virus wouldn't penetrate, but that's just not how the virus works. It's, you know, it doesn't discriminate. It doesn't matter where you are.
Mm. And I mean, was there, so it sounds like there was pressure to not wear masks.
Yeah, I certainly felt that. I, you know, I was always very cognizant. I always told myself, you know, I scrubbed my hand, washed my hands every day. I tried everything to do not to touch common surfaces because for me, I didn't want to be that person that infected the vice president who I worked very closely with. And I think it was just a culture where people in the White House at the most senior political levels never took it seriously. They at times, they just didn't think it was real. They thought it was overblown. And when you walked into the room with a mask, you got the looks. You know, people rolled their eyes. It was just a very awkward situation.
So, Olivia, I really appreciate your perspective here from having been in the room and also your long career as a national security expert for the United States. Because, of course, in issues of national security, information management is of vital importance. And that also applies in pandemic management, right? I mean, in the case of pandemic management, sort of a clear, sober recitation of the facts to the American people really, really matters. So, I mean, honestly, how would you judge what the White House has been doing around the facts of the president's health over the past couple of days?
I think it's a prime case of the White House spin and how they've handled the pandemic overall. I think, you know, you're watching Dr. Conley. What you're seeing on TV with Dr. Conley is the struggle that the experts and the doctors on the task force have faced every single day. I saw it firsthand, where he is trying to give candid, accurate information. But I can tell you, I'm sure that he is getting bullied behind the scenes saying, you've got to stay on message. For a Navy officer who I know has integrity, I know this has got to be very hard for him to walk this fine line where he is trying, you know, I don't believe that he is lying. I think he is trying to tell the truth in a manner that is true to who he is and the oath of office that he took when he, you know, chose to serve in the military. But I also think that the dynamics around him to play down the president's condition, if that is indeed the case, are wrong. I mean, this is just, you know, the American public deserves to know what is happening with our commander in chief. What is going on? Is the vice president ready? Is he taking over? I mean, where is it? And I think the president, you know, he does not like to show weakness and he does not waver on the fact that he will not let go of that office no matter what. And I think, you know, this is just very poorly managed by the chief of staff, Mark Meadows, and everyone who is messaging contradictory to each other. This is how you end up in the crisis that we're in today with the pandemic on how it's still playing out.
Olivia, if I may ask, when you said that you're sure that Dr. Connolly is being bullied behind the scenes, bullied by whom?
I would say the highest ranks within the White House. You know, the communications teams, the president's own family members. I have seen this. I have seen how they behave when you're just a public servant trying to do the right thing. This is, you know, we're in a public health emergency and crisis. This response, it's no different than the way they have behaved when the national security community and the intelligence community have tried to give warnings on other areas of national security concerns, such as foreign adversaries or the election. What you're seeing is the continuing undermining of career dedicated professionals and the data and facts. And you're watching it play firsthand now directly with the president and his condition in his life.
So when you mention the president's own family members and you've seen this firsthand, can you tell us specifically who and what you're talking about?
Like, I can tell you for a fact that Jared Kushner himself never took this virus seriously. I offered to social distance. There were times when I felt uncomfortable because I realized he is the president's son-in-law. I would make a point. Sometimes he would ask why I wasn't sitting at the table or sitting next to him. And I would say, I'm trying to be respectful of you and me. And I'm looking at the vice president at the end of the table. And I'm thinking, you're the president's son-in-law. You should be taking this seriously. You should be protecting your father-in-law and the commander-in-chief and the vice president and all of us. And it was just frustrating because, you know, he waved me off and said an expletive and said, I'm not bothered with that. I'm not concerned about it. And that is just a plain disregard from day one that has been the case. And that is a prime example of a person who is in the inner circle with great influence and steering the direction of this pandemic response. And he has the audacity to sort of behave in a manner that's so cavalier when there are high stakes here.
Paula Reed, respond to what you're hearing. What do you think?
It doesn't surprise me at all. Olivia and I have had other conversations about what goes on behind the scenes. The question for today appears to be whether the president is going to, again, apply this pressure that we've been talking about directly on his medical staff and his own staff to allow him to return to the White House. The chief of staff laid the groundwork for that this morning on Fox News, saying they hope that he could come home today or tomorrow. Now, it's unlikely Mark Meadows would come out and set that expectation and then not follow through, because, of course, that would raise even more concerns about the president's health. So it appears that now the pressure is being applied across the board to allow the president to return home, not because that's the medical assessment, because the president believes that remaining at Walter Reed makes him look weak. And, of course, when he returns to the White House, he's not only exposing his staff, administration officials, but also the people who work at the White House across administrations, people who can't just go quarantine for 2 weeks, mm-hmm. people who don't necessarily have the kind of health care that he receives. That's what we're watching today and likely tomorrow as well.
Olivia, we've got a question coming in from one of our listeners who wants to know, where is the vice president during all this chaos? Do you think he is being bullied?
You know, I think I have seen the vice president be put in impossible positions repeatedly throughout, especially this pandemic and through other situations in my over 2 years of tenure working on his national security team and staff. And I think, you know, I hope that he is taking the right precautions. And I certainly hope that his own chief of staff and his immediate staff are being very cognizant of the fact that all of them have potentially been exposed to the virus, and they need to be very careful, because at the end of the day, he is in line to assume responsibility should something happen to the president. And I think I know the vice president. I know he takes his role very seriously, and I hope that he is heeding the advice of those around him, and hopefully not the advice of the president's inner circle, but the advice of what the medical and the experts that serve on the task force with him, such as Dr. Fauci. He has resources there to help him get through this.
Mm-hmm. I want to just ask you a couple of questions about the national security implications of what is happening right now with the president of the United States. Nobody wants a president while in office to fall sick like this. Nobody wants this. And it does have reverberations far beyond the White House, right? I mean, the whole world knows right now that the president and his national security team, I mean, there's no way they can be operating at 100% because they are consumed by this catastrophe, right? And then isn't this also sending a global message right now that the White House itself couldn't protect its own staff from this pandemic? And so why would the global community, I mean, doesn't that expose us to weaknesses, to national security weaknesses more broadly?
It certainly does, Magda. And honestly, it's embarrassing to watch the White House, you know, of the world's superpower behave in such a manner, and to have this on such displayed globally on in such a glaring manner that shows just the lack of regard for what this pandemic is, for what all of our international partners have been facing. And it shows a tremendous sense of weakness to our adversaries who are just watching it. I mean, I'm sure that they are just, this is just another day in the Trump White House where this is once again on full display how the incompetence and the risk that this entire administration at the very top has put all of us through.
Good. Just 2 minutes left, Olivia, and one more question for you, because I heard you at the beginning of our conversation really underscore you felt that it was your patriotic duty to serve in multiple offices over your long career in government. I mean, given that, I think one of the great tragedies of this moment, it feels there's a sad inevitability to what has happened. This didn't need to happen. The president of the United States did not need to contract the coronavirus. 7 million Americans didn't need to contract it. 210,000 Americans didn't need to die. I mean, I just wonder how that's all settling on you right now as you watch this like terrible tragedy, in a sense, coming home to roost in the White House.
You know, it's something that I think about every single day. I reflect on it before I go to bed. It has bothered me every single day in my role in the White House. And just morally, it was a struggle when I worked there. And as hard as this has been to talk about this, and you know, I'll get off interviews and I will feel emotionally drained because it's so real to me, but it's so important. It's so important that people really understand firsthand what has led us to where we are today.
Well, Olivia Troy, she has had worked in the United States government since after the attacks of 9/11, all the way through her time at the Department of Homeland Security and the Office of the Vice President, and as an aide to the White House COVID Task Force. Olivia, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Magda.
And Paula Reed, CBS News White House correspondent and Justice Department correspondent. Paula, thank you as always for helping us understand the great tangle of information that comes from this White House. Paula, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.